Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Last week we presented Professor's 7th talk in this series, and today we'll be bringing you a question and answer session based on Professor's earlier talks in this series. The questions will, as always, will be posed by a panel, and today the panelists are Professor Peter Prusen from Denmark and Radio Sai's Bishu Prushti. As always, Professor G. Venkatraman will be answering and clarifying the questions put up by the panelists. So, over to you, Professor Venkatraman, for his opening remarks and then taking it further.
My opening remarks are addressed to Sunil. What about Talk 7? You don't want any questions? I did not say I don't want questions on Talk 7. Okay, you said earlier talks.
Earlier talks, yes.
Okay. I know you didn't mean it. But it's a way of provoking the two people here to ask questions on Talk 7. For the simple reason, it is the latest that I have forgotten. Okay, over to you.
Yeah, I think I would request Professor Peter Prusen to...
Thank you. I will definitely start with Talk 7. And I'd like to ask a very, what I would call, sensitive or tricky question. How it is sensitive will be clear in a few moments. In your last talk, you referred to the assembly hall, where it was clear to all that Shakuni was cheating, Yudhishthira. And you said that not a single person protested and tried to get Yudhishthira Dhritarashtra to stop the game, not even the wise elder Bhishma or Dronacharya, or not even the Pandavas. And then you said, I quote, "Few bother to comment and draw attention to egregious violations of Dharma. People, even those of integrity, remain silent when values and basic moral principles are being openly flouted." You continued, "If people know that things are happening that are not good and are bound to have undesirable consequences later, then why don't they speak out strongly and prevent the looming disaster?" I think everyone would agree with that, but I'd like to comment on how difficult this can be and refer to the problems that Radio Sai has had, or that Heart to Heart has had. I'll refer to particular incidents.
Mm-hmm. Which incident in Heart to Heart are you referring to?
It goes back a number of years. There was a series called Living Up to the Challenge of Conscience in Daily Life.
Yes.
And it referred to a highly skilled executive in the United States in the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
A person with a high reputation. She joined a new company, was highly paid, had chosen the job also because it was close to the school where her children attended. And after a short while, she found out that the company was cheating the data. They were fixing up the data so that a new drug would be approved by the very powerful Food and Drug Administration in the United States. She challenged the CEO of the company with this several times, listened, but totally disregarded her.
Yes.
She felt very bad, was having stress symptoms, and finally she made a very big decision. She would leave the company. She did that, and she said that she followed the voice of her conscience. And not too long after that, she received an even better job.
Yeah.
She also told that sometime after that karma had worked, that company that was cheating gradually went down the drain and failed.
Yes.
And I contacted Radio Sai then with the following question. I said, she said that Radio Sai had the headline, "A Dharmic Decision."
Yeah.
But was it a dharmic decision? She did not blow the whistle. She did not stop the company from getting a potentially unsafe drug approved. And to refer to what Professor Venkatraman said, she did not prevent the looming disaster. So, many applauded her decision as being dharmic. Radio Sai did. But I did not. In fact, as I mentioned, I had written to Radio Sai about that. So it appears to me that Dharma, although we can feel strongly about it, is open to considerable interpretation. And I'd like to ask Professor Venkatraman for his comments.
I would like to say, just to add to what Sir said, in that situation, actually that lady was from Canada, if I remember right.
Excuse me.
And I remember we did that story some time back. And in that case, she tried her best. She did whatever she can to ensure that the company doesn't come out with that product.
Yes.
But the company was unrelenting because all the marketing departments were sort of governing the whole way the company was functioning. And when she realized that she's not in a position to change mm-hmm. what the company was doing, then she said, okay, then I don't want to be part of it. And she came out of it.
That's
so I would think that if you're in a situation where you can bring about that positive change, then you should do it. But if you're in a position, like for example, if she was the CEO of the company, or if she had a senior position or a position of influence where she can actually bring about that difference, then yes, she should have definitely done that. And probably here she tried what she can, but when she realized that she cannot, then she said, I don't want to be part of it.
But she didn't take the final step. And the final step was trying to prevent the company from damaging potentially millions of other people.
Okay.
How do you expect her to do that?
I expect her to do that by going public, going to the press, going to the radio, the television, whatever it is. Since the late 1960s, the term blowing the whistle has become popular. This is, in my country, laws protect people who blow the whistle. You're not able to sue or fire or whatnot a person who goes public and talks about something that is immoral.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't agree with you. You are laying down procedures of how to carry forward your objections.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that for the following reason. If you look at the Ramayana, Ravana had called a meeting because the enemy had landed. Mm-hmm. And he says, I want advice. In fact, he gives what is a good advice, what is not a good advice. And his definition of good advice is the best ever given. Mm-hmm. But that's a different story. So, different people say different things. But Vibhishana gets up and he says, you are flat wrong. You are violating the rules. And in public he said that, and he walked out. And that has been healed. The point is that she had spoken out to the fellow who is committing the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't necessarily have to, if the circumstances are favorable, you do the follow-up action. But she has registered her conscientious objection. And there are times when you cannot do certain things like that. For example, if you are working in government, there is a matter of national security.
Yes.
You register your this thing, but you keep quiet.
Yeah.
And for instance, there is a meeting that Kennedy refers to in the Cuban crisis. There are only 9 people present.
Mm.
And he asked them, essentially it boiled down to, do they attack Cuba or not? If they attack Cuba, it is World War III. Are you ready for that? And everyone said that this is dangerous, but if we don't attack, it is even more dangerous. We should attack.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy said, I have listened to all of you, but I have another option, and as president, I am going to adopt it. But what I am saying and what we have discussed will be secret. They all signed, and the idea was that after the last man died, that paper would be open. That's how last man to die was Ted Sorensen,
yes,
who was Kennedy's speechwriter. What Kennedy said is, there is one other way. I'm going to ask my brother Bobby Kennedy to go to the Soviet embassy in half an hour and give them a deal. I'm going to give Khrushchev a face-saving deal because he's a politician, he has to survive. But that will be kept secret. Publicly, he will withdraw his missiles. But he knows that I am giving him a promise which I will execute 6 months later because politically I can't do it. Mm-hmm. Basically, Khrushchev said, you have got missiles in Turkey, why can't I put it in Cuba? You did it first, you remove. But then he said he understands politics, he will agree. So there was a decision, protest made by the president. He went against this for the larger good, and it was kept secret. But the other point that I am trying to make is, when it is happening on a large scale, There is one incident I wanted to put, but my talk was getting too long, so give me a couple of minutes to explain it. Soon after I came, Professor Sampath was vice chancellor at that time. He was the third vice chancellor. He gave me a book. He said, "Dr. Venkatraman, read it. There are about 40 articles there." I read it, and then I gave it back. In fact, I had put it in my draft, but it was getting too long. So maybe this is a way of getting it out. He asked me, "What do you think of it?" I said, "Most of the articles are pretty boring. They say the same thing. Only three were different. These were all written by vice chancellors." He said, "You are right. All the fellows who wrote boring articles were yes men who, after their vice chancellorship, wanted some other sinecure. It's like governorship. I know many vice chancellors who became governors. The three people who spoke out were people who explicitly said what is wrong with the educational system. There's a background to this. Till independence, education was controlled by the British. The British did not interfere with academic affairs because they had no political interest. We want the system to run, and we want it to be run this way. Actually, the system worked very well for that period because there was no academic interference. After the Constitution was promulgated and India adopted it, education became a state subject as in the United States. The federal government has no control over it except in some broad-based policy matters. So each state began to use education as a lever for getting votes. And it completely drove out meritocracy. And nobody complained about it. They could have. But three people wrote articles. So here was something in public knowledge of which lots of people are grumbling privately, but nobody said anything. It is not as in a company where only one or two are aware of it. The whole world knew it. But nobody in positions took a stand and started a campaign. There was no need to blow a whistle. That is a negligence. That is the kind of thing that I am saying. These guys knew the whole game was rigged. They should have said, "This is a rigged game. We are not here to see a match, fixed match. This is not being played according to rules." And the point is, if you look at the Wall Street crisis of 2008, there are three or four people who predicted it. And I went and saw what people have said post event. Most of them said, "It so happened that circumstances came together and there was a crash." That's not true. They were gambling with other people's money. Okay, how long can you go on winning? It's not the job of a bank to become a casino. That is something fundamentally wrong. Bank's job is not to take somebody's money and gamble. Everybody knew it. Nobody talked about it, except a few people took it to, said, "If you do this, that's going to happen." And after the housing bubble, this was sort of expected to happen. It is not like an earthquake, which you cannot exactly forecast. So what happened? Basically, I'm complaining about desensitization. What do I bother if it does not concern me?
I think that when I raised this question, I was putting myself hypothetically in that person's place, and I asked myself, would my conscience be good? Would it feel clear? And my answer was no. And again, it's easy to put to make such imaginary situations. But I asked myself, would I feel good? Would I feel that I had done the right thing in leaving, without trying to prevent what could have been a tragic occurrence? And that was the so I guess there's no simple and straightforward answer to this question, but certainly it underlines that as Das is emphasizing in his book, that this notion of dharma can be subtle and at times difficult
to learn. It is subtle. I don't believe it is subtle. Yes, you will be tested. Certain questions require sharp buddhi. Actually, we have to pay attention to what Swami says. He says, "You have spoken according to your conscience and left. As far as I am concerned, I am not worried about the results." you have acted according to your conscience. You are ready to give up your job. That is a sacrifice you have done. When a CEO would say, what about your turnover? What about that? God says, I don't look at those things. You have acted according to your conscience within this framework, and that is enough for me. But what about the other people sitting there? Das gives a story in the book which you might have read. This is about a company of which he was a member, whose board he was a member of. And that company used to make a lot of profit, but 80% of its sales were to government agencies. And government agencies being what they are, to pay your money back to them, you will have to give bribe. So at some point, this fellow said, I'm not going to stand for that, the CEO. It came up in the board. So he said, I'm going to pull off my business. Now that is a risky thing. That is a customer who is buying 80% of your products, and the public market is only 20%. It is a very risky thing to do. He said, yeah, but I'll build up. My sales will come down, I'll build up. And thus says, he agreed with him, although most others did not. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm not going to pay bribes anymore. Let me see what happens. He lost. He had to fire people, but his business came back. And the point is, if he had continued to pay bribes, his company might have collapsed and all the people might have lost their jobs. He stuck to his guns. And this is an example from his own experience. Yes, I agree that it's not subtle. It is a question of how you act and the consequences of the damage.
But isn't it also...
The consequences of action. And there, Swami is very clear. You don't go by consequences. Mm-hmm. You see whether you have followed my rule. I control destiny and I can change it if I want. That is a very hard sell to people who are not willing to accept dharma. So they live in the so-called real world, pragmatic world. No, this won't buy, this won't do. I'm dealing with Russia, Putin, this, that, and all that. Okay, you have painted yourself into a corner and then say dharma is subtle, dharma won't work. Mm. But his point is, what about starting right from the beginning? I'm not willing to slam that door shut. People are slamming the door shut. They have no solution. They say, come on, man. If you sacrifice, after all, you have come out of Second World War. So it's not impossible.
In fact, prison.
Mentioning war brings me to a related topic.
But what about that?
Mentioning
war.
I'd like to go back 155 years, roughly, 160 years, to the American Civil War. And I touch on that because in your last talk, you introduced the concept of slavery. That was based, of course, based on Draupadi's, one of the two questions that she asked about whether she was sold by her husband. You refer to the American Declaration of Independence, which starts with some amazingly beautiful statements about the inalienable rights of people to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
All
men are created equal. And I looked into that, and I remember some years ago there was a marvelous exhibition in New York City where they showed some copies of the Declaration of Independence.
It's there in the National Archives exhibit. Yes. I saw that.
And it is interesting that Abraham Lincoln, who was one of the heroic figures in American history and also often called upon by Swami as an example of a person who came from very humble means and really followed his dharma, it is interesting that prior to the Civil War, he was challenged. There were debates. And I don't remember the name of the debater, but a highly...
A man called Douglas or something.
Perhaps.
I can't remember.
Someone who challenged him, and essentially he was saying that he was obeying the moral law because what the Declaration of Independence was referring to, not to what he called I can't remember the exact words, secondary or underdeveloped races. In other words, that the statement did not apply to universally, as it did not apply to animals. So, and what is interesting is that a large number of people shared those perspectives, and if I recall correctly, historians have said that they did so not just because slave owners had an economic interest, but they really had that as a feeling. Their conscience told them that this was the correct way, that slavery was a not only suitable, but a good thing, almost God-ordained behavior. And for me, that underlines the difficulty. We know that Dharma is universal. We know that it is permanent. It is not mutable. And nevertheless, people dependent upon their societal norms apparently are able to feel that they are acting according to the moral law, while we today would scoff at that and say, no, you are not.
You refer to the conscience telling them. The conscience can never say that. It is their mind telling them.
Yes.
And the mind has got itself aligned for various reasons to prevailing social norms. And one of the norms is that black people are backward, they are dull, they are intelligent and all that. And it was propagated so much, I did not quite believe. But I said that they are backward because they are being suppressed and all that. Some months ago, there is an 8-year-old poet from Nigeria who has won the Nobel Prize, I believe, for literature. His poetry was being read out on BBC. I was astonished. I mean, he is not an African-American in the sense there is a lot of what you call intermingling of races. He was articulating like anyone else. And I hear members of parliament in Nigeria, and they were supposed to wear suit and ties. They speak English. Yeah, there's a bit of an accent. They're as communicative as anyone else. In fact, BBC had a fellow from Nigeria who died, and they celebrated his anniversary with a lot of tributes. So we somehow believe that these people are inferior and these people are superior. And these are what you call bridges and walls we have, rather walls we have built in our minds. The whole problem, therefore, is the pollution of the mind.
Yes.
And Swami says, when the mind is polluted, aberration sets in very easily and justifies it with 10,000 very ingenious excuses. And that is where the so-called subtlety to remove it, there is a knife. And that knife is never referred to by Das or anybody, because they are not aware of it. And that knife is called buddhi.
Yes.
Discrimination, that is separating. Now, careful people talk of two knives. One is discriminating very sharply on worldly matters. People like Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski are very sharp. I listen to them. They're very analytical, especially on matters of East Europe, Middle East, and China and all that. Very, very shrewd.
They're brilliant.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I look forward to their comments. But here we are talking about spiritual matters. At the end of the day, humanness is a spiritual attribute. And when it comes to that, your buddhi must be sharp. And that is why in the very second chapter of the Gita, first chapter, the headline is, Arjuna, you are not the body, you are the Atma. Second chapter is, Arjuna, if your buddhi is not sharp, you will go to, you are condemned to death, self-destruction and ruin. And if you discuss dharma and its subtlety and never bring in buddhi, I think it is fatally wrong. It's like talking about surgery without making any reference to any surgical tool.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more.
Also, if we try to derive morality from changing societal norms and societal behavior. I think that is also where we probably we will be going wrong, because morality, as Sir has been mentioning from the start of this series, it has to be hinged on something from which is the source of morality, which is divinity. If we try
more important is, it's unchanging.
It's unchanging. Yes.
See, that is a point of view people contest today. That is why former Pope Benedict referred to the tyranny of relativism.
Yes.
And what is the meaning of relativism? I say this is moral, you say this is moral. Your morals may be different from my morals. But Swami always said there is no such thing as Indian truth, American truth, Chinese truth, Pakistani truth. Mm-hmm. Truth is only one and it's the same for all. That's not acceptable. They know it in their heart of hearts. If you really take them privately for a long walk and say, come on, be honest. Yeah, I agree with you, but you know it's not going to work.
It's not convenient for us.
So that is where this real politic, pragmatism, all these things. So you clutched, you hang on to those last straw and see whether you subsplode. That's very common. I understand those problems. It is not that I diminish. You know, I came up from nuclear energy and I have been watching that scenario for many, many years. The weapons side, as an observer. And when you go to Pugwash and all that, there is a lot of loaded talk. There is a lot of loaded talk. I can understand that. But nobody has the guts. Rajiv Gandhi said that. He went to the United Nations General Assembly when he was Prime Minister. He said, come on, you're talking of nuclear war and all. Let us all disarm. We are ready to sign first. Are you ready? The feeling is, five elders are the Pandavas, and they are wise. All others are idiots. So you must be, your little boys, we'll tell you how to behave. Mm. That sort of thing doesn't work. Well, all men are created, all nations are created. Some are more equal than others. Again, you see that. That is not the way to look at these things. There is a fundamentally different way of looking at it. And the reason why I am hammering away at that is, you know, I listen to Swami's discourses often. I happened to be listening to one. He was giving with great difficulty. It was delivered on October 9, 2005. His voice was breaking in the beginning, but it picked up. Throughout the discussion, he is saying, you are God. There is nothing other than God. When there is only God, how can you go and hurt God?
Exactly.
He, just because you see some form, that form is there for a certain purpose. In a drama, people will have to wear different costumes and assume different roles. So, in Julius Caesar, Brutus has no business to go and really stab Julius Caesar. He will pretend to stab and Julius Caesar will pretend to die and so on and so forth. And at the end of it all, they'll anxiously wait for the early morning newspaper and what the New York Times drama critic has to say. So this is a play and you don't realize it. And I was astonished. 40 minutes he kept on saying, there is nothing other than God. You are not realizing it. You are not willing to believe it. Nobody goes on saying that. But the fact is true.
In fact, I was reading Samashava's Bhagwan in Vrindavan, 1979, where Swami very clearly is saying that Samajika Dharma, Dharma for the society, is derived from Ishwara Dharma, Swami says. And Swadharma, or which individual Dharma, which the way people understand it, that is derived from Samajika Dharma, the Dharma for the society. So it starts with Ishwara Dharma. From Ishwara Dharma comes Samajika Dharma. From Samajika Dharma comes Swadharma or individual Dharma. I think if this line of thinking is followed, then I think there will never be those issues of, you know, people having people's conscience speaking differently in different lands.
That your point is well taken, but people are not aware of this.
Absolutely.
So, for example, I'm working on talk 8, and I'm reading Das in between quite frequently. And he makes a point that if you do something for society and also because you do something for yourself and in the process society gets benefited, that is a great thing because, let me see if I get it right, that is not being selfish. Technically, if you go by the English language, it is correct. But Swami does not start with selfishness. He starts with the attachment to the body. Selfishness is a consequence of attachment to God. Dehabhimanam.
Yes.
Mindness. Now, what I was feeling was, I was thinking about it and said, imagine a tailor of the old days who has to stitch everything. He's stitching a shirt. He has cut out a piece of cloth to be stitched as the pocket. That cloth is there, this is there. See, he wants to take a coffee break and he's sipping. Some coffee spills. Supposing it spills on the smaller cloth, that is ruined. If it spills on the larger cloth, that is ruined. So the damage is there, damage is here. Suppose he has finished the shirt and then spilled. It doesn't matter where the thing is. The whole shirt is ruined. Now, what does that got to do with what you're discussing? See, if I don't look at my body, but look at my conscience or consciousness, that is one continuum. It is linked to your consciousness, it is linked to yours and Sunil's and whole. It's like the whole shirt. So wherever it is ruined, it is ruined. Mm-hmm. It does not make any difference which part of it ruined. That is an irrelevant thing. I have to protect it. So that is why Swami is pressing, if you live in a society, don't dissociate and disconnect yourself from society. If you do good to society, it benefits you. If the shirt is clean, the pocket is clean.
Yes.
So we don't think like that. Mm. Now, in these days, we are encouraged to think in segmented, except in certain things. All of you, please go and see this movie. All of you, please go and watch that cricket match and spend a lot of money there while you're there. That is the problem. These are all tricks played by the mind. And people say that it is very difficult to solve the problems, which is scandalous. If the same mind can do many things, fantastic things like putting a big explorer on the surface of the Mars, which is going day and night, using what you call nuclear battery and sending signals all the time. It has landed by itself. It was not landed by direct control. It had a program and it worked and it landed. So man can do such things. Hmm. You know, he has unraveled the gene. Now he's going to unravel the brain, neural connections. You mean to say he cannot solve the problem of nuclear disarmament? That is why Freeman Dyson in his book Weapons and Hope says, it is easy to teach Indians to be like Americans, but it is very difficult to teach Americans to be like Indians. What he means is, they must learn Karma Yoga, chapter 2. I mean, he is indirectly referring to Bhagavad Gita. He says so.
Yes.
I was stunned. Bhagavad Gita is of value even in nuclear disarmament. Don't take my word for it. Freeman Dyson says that and he has built a smart hydrogen bomb.
In fact, in one of these discourses, in the same summer showers 1979, Swami very powerfully says, many people fallaciously imagine that spirituality is only concerned with salvation.
Exactly.
Swami says, spirituality is in fact the backbone of society and is indispensable for social progress and solidarity. Its importance for and relevance to society cannot be exaggerated. It's really amazing. And many times so many people, you know, so-called, we think we are spiritual and the whole concept is even though who are very devoted and have a lot of faith, etc., love for God, but even for them, spirituality is concerned with their salvation.
Yeah, in fact, I have to search it out. About 2 months ago, somebody sent me a mail with an attachment. Once I go to my office, I'll try to locate it. It is a paper on spirituality by a member of the faculty of IIM Bangalore, Indian Institute of Management, Bangalore. His first sentence is, spirituality is all connected with seeking liberation. His second sentence is, it has nothing to do with service to society. I nearly had a heart attack. Then I said to myself, what crap is this? Mm. Now you say, see, you know why Swami is saying that? This is connected with his statement of linkages. And he used to refer to it at times. Vyashti, Samashti, Srishti, Parameshti.
Yes.
Vyashti is the individual. Samashti is society. The individual is a part of society.
Yes.
Society is a part of nature, which is Srishti.
Yes.
And nature is a part of God, which is Parameshti. So if I see my hand, hand is a part of the arm. Arm is a part of the body. So there is a hierarchy, there is a connectivity.
Yes.
If you do fragmented thinking, you will miss connectivity. And the moment you miss connectivity,
yes,
the network is not complete. And in an incomplete network, you may, if you run it for running your programs, you may get a lot of wrong results. But he was very insistent about this, seeking this thread of continuity through the apparent hierarchy and seeing the omnipresence of God.
Yes. Amazing. In fact, you have dealt with this in great detail in your series on awareness.
Have I? I don't remember. Maybe I should go and read it.
Yeah, we have had that on the Radiosai website with illustrations. All these 8 or 9 talks that you gave, your musings on awareness. I think it was all the time on this concept.
Oh, now I remember. It was a twin series. One was awareness, other
and
was Gita.
Yes, so I think I'm really tempted to discuss more, but I think time is running out, so we will have to stop at this point. But I think this is something which we really need to think over. And
yeah, allow me to give one quote of Einstein, which is connected with the mind's trickeries.
Yes.
He made a statement which goes like this. No problem can be solved at the level of consciousness at which it is created.
Great.
Meaning, if mind has created a problem, it cannot solve it.
Yes.
David Bohm wrote a book called Thought as a Process. I've quoted this often. He says, the mind is very good at creating problems. But if it sits down to solve the problems, it will create more problems. So there will be a problem divergence, and the mind can never solve it. And in simpler words, the mind is screwed up. Go one step higher to the level of the heart, the problems get solved. And that is what is beautifully illustrated in the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Yes.
3 guys go, 2 guys consult the mind. Mind says, what's there in for you? Keep going. The heart says, idiot, if you were in that position, would you not want help? Go and help him.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately it does. So the problem of the man was solved by someone going to the level of the heart.
Yes.
Now, if there are 7.2 billion of us and we at least 1 billion rise to the level of the heart, so many of the problems can be solved.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We don't want to pay that price of shedding our dehabhimanam. Mm-hmm. Ah, I can't do that. That's too high a price. Sorry, I took a couple of your minutes away.
No, actually even I'm tempted to go on, but I think we will have to stop because Raghu...
I think I'm getting some darts from Sunil.
Raghu will be waiting for service, love in action. So dear listeners, I know even as this discussion is going on, you also probably would have had many questions. So please feel free as always to write to listener@radiosai.org and it permits, and we'll see how it goes next week. Probably we will have another Q&A session before we have the next musing of Professor Venkatraman. Thank you so much, Professor Peter Prusen, for being with us.
Sai Ram.
Thank you.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end the 11th question and answer session based on Professor G. Venkatraman's earlier talks in this new series based on Dharma. We hope you liked the session, and next week we'll be continuing with the present series. Please don't forget to tune in then, and we shall alert you in advance with web and radio announcements about what's coming up the next week. So watch out this space. We thank you for listening, and as always, the podcast of this program may be accessed via our website www.radiosai.org. Dear listeners, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org. And coming up next on Thursday Live is a segment Service, Love in Action. Please stay tuned and thank you and Sai Ram. Tune in to Sai.
Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Gaana Lola.
Allah قدرت کے سب بندے ایک نور تے سب جگ اپجیارا رام ہرے ہری نام بول